Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, financial statement analysis. As usual, we will take a little bit of time here to look at the markets. And before we get down to the details of the day, this will be a day when you should have your computers out, because I'm going to show you how to access some data and then use Excel to do some analytics. But again, before that, the markets here. And let's find someone who's willing to be victimized. Sir, was this a bull or a bear day? Something of a bull day. It started out as a very strong bull day, and then it just kind of died. Now, remember what I said, that we had had a bear day on Monday, and even yesterday was something of a bear day. But now today, there was, see that big spike of stock prices going up? It's a bull, it's a bear market, but there was that jump right there. Now, madam, do you remember what we call that? We have a jump in stock prices in a bear market. We call that a? You don't remember? Do you remember what we call that? I'll give you a hint, yeah?
Dead cat bounce.
Dead cat bounce. Now, that was a pretty decent one there at the beginning. That cat was bloated and it bonging, and then, of course, it was dead, so it went back down. But there was definitely a dead cat bounce there, as I had said there probably would be. It was a little bit later, a day behind when I thought it would happen. But now we're going back. By the end, you see the bears were beginning to take control of this situation and tear it back down. Essentially, profit taking was happening. The dead cat bounce brought stocks up. And in fact, I had a risky position in a derivative. And at first, I mean, I was up really good on it. And then I held on to it too long, and it just died back down. And I, at the end of the day, it looks like I'm going to make a little bit, but I was up really nicely. And then there you go. There's your problem, of course. There's an old saying, in a bear market, don't try to catch falling knives. And that's what you're doing anytime you play in a bear market. It's going to go down. If you're a bull and you're just trying to catch a quick bargain, well, that can burn you, as it did me. I mean, it was pretty exciting there. I thought, yeah, this is good, but I should have traded out about midday, because by the end of the day, it was just like, now see how it's... Now, you also see that the Dow is now down for the day. It was up really good. That's interesting, because the biggest companies are dropping the hardest. Do you see this? There's the Dow 30 is down 0.60%, and the Dow and the S&P 500, which is a broader index, is down 0.4%. The NASDAQ is right. Oh, the NASDAQ is taking a beating right now. Ouch. Okay, now you see crude. As I had told you before, crude is wanting to try to get there. It's $100 a barrel. It's what it wants. It had a couple of down days, but the money is on it, trying to find 100. Now that, under normal circumstances, I would say I'll probably see 100 after spring break. We come back and we'll see it floating in the 95 to 98, somewhere in there. However, there are some things that could cause that price to go up before then. We are definitely really configuring for a war now. Whether we'll have one or not, these things have happened before. But I mean, there are the shipping lanes, the reports of transfers of weaponry, forward bases being laid out. It looks like this might be might be serious enough. And if there's a war there, well, it could spill out. And if it spilled out, first of all, if we kick Russia, Russia is a large source of hydrocarbon products moving into Western Europe and down through South Asia, Anatolia. So it would not be really cool if those supplies got cut off in a war. So that would be that would kick the price up badly. If somehow the Middle East gets involved in this in one way or another, then you've got the vulnerability of the very large dirty tankers in the Persian Gulf and then trying to make their way through the Strait of Hormuz if Iran decides it wants to get pissy. And then if our ally over there decides that it's time to bomb Iran before it gets a nuclear weapon, then that gets to be a really fun thing. Then it gets really like a party. So you guys are going to be the ones who are drafted into that war, so it's not my issue. But crude oil, if there is a really big several events, one event, several events, you'll see crude reacting very strongly because of the expectation of supply cutoffs. Now remember, it's not whether or not the supply of crude gets cut off. It's the expectation. That's the way everything in financial markets work. Okay, gold and silver were down. This is weird. This is really weird. You got stocks losing their oomph. The metals are losing their oomph. Now, probably some metal money going into oil, but that's not where investors usually go. Now, the 10-year bond, the yields went up 6.5 basis points. That's on the expectation that the Fed is going to clamp down on the money supply. But if yields are going up, bond prices are going down. So you've got stock prices going down. You've got at least some commodities prices going down. You've got bond prices going down. So where the hell is that money going? That would probably mean that it's going into cash, straight up. Just, and when I say cash, that's usually treasury bills. Yeah. Say that again. What was it that it? Oh, yeah, about that. Yeah, I know. Interestingly enough, Bitcoin has been beaten crapless, and so is Ethereum. I mean, all of the coins. I mean, they've just taken it really on the chin. Interestingly enough, though, is that there's a lot of debate now among professionals. Are the cryptos actually a haven, a safe haven? Now, this big, huge drop in them tells us that they're still risky AF. But at the same time, they're out there. And I mean, you can move money into crypto insanely quickly now. Just to give you an idea, when I thought that Ethereum had bottomed out, I just bought some more gas fee money. Ethereum is a gas fee. Gas fees are how you mint NFTs. That's a term, and it costs money because the blockchain expects to be paid for the process of putting your contract or your token or whatever into the chain somewhere. So you buy Ethereum to pay those fees. I bought some Ethereum, and I just am amazed that I can turn $100 into ETH, Ethereum coins, in a split second with no transaction fee. It's got extremely high liquidity. There's no question about that. But at the same time, God, when the price of it is fluctuating that much against the dollar, ouch. And interestingly, even the things that are denominated in crypto seem to move as the crypto moves against the dollar. So I'm wondering if crypto is even beginning to turn into more of a proxy for a U.S. dollar than it is its own currency. That's all neither here nor there. But at some point, I do want to expose you more directly to cryptocurrencies. But in order to do that, I have to teach you about the concept of a blockchain. Blockchains are just taking over the world. Fortunately, just like I said in a radio interview a few months ago, most people are going to have no idea that this has happened. The whole world is going to be changed within a year, and only those who are on the inside, the students and the players, know that this has happened. We're making it so that it doesn't look like anything is happening, but it is. As a matter of fact, I've just bought a couple of crypto domains in the last 24 hours just to get my position solid. But anyway, I'll take you through that later in the course. You need to know it. I don't know if I told you, but there was a message that came through a few days ago. There's a very large business here in town, and I don't know, I wasn't told who it was, but I can guess. And they wanted a crypto expert here at the university to give a speech on crypto for their executives. And the one thing was, they said, we'll give you as much as 30 minutes. Yeah. And the other thing is that they were going to pay me $100. Yeah. Okay. Now, they'll have to wait until they find out what's going on. Okay, anyway. Now I'm going to take you off this. And we're going to go to the subject of the lecture today. And there's a historical lesson, a history lesson in here too. Now it has a political side to it. Deal with it. I don't play in opinions or maybes. I tell you what happened. And that's something that is uncomfortable for both leftists and right-wingers both, because history tends to put either of them in a bad light somewhere along the way. But this one is definitely what really happened. And I'll begin after the Civil War, which at the time was called the War Between the States. The Civil War part of it kind of got popular later. But the North had won, and one of the problems was that the South had had a huge hatred of the North. And of course, obviously, the South was involved in the abomination of slavery. But there was also this anger at the North that had to do with how banking and shipping was controlled by the northern states. And they would say these things about these conspiracies among the rich fat cats of the north and all this kind of stuff, controlling the banks, controlling the ships, and controlling Congress, which would pass laws that favored the north and their products and would not favor the south. And Well, not to a certain extent, they were right. And after the war was over, it would have been great if everyone had gotten their major crap together. You lay off this crap with the slavery and all of this shit that you were doing, and the North, you guys need to stop thinking that you're the gods of commerce and finance. Didn't work out that way. And we were in a situation where the North was controlled by the bankers. Our politicians were the best money could buy. A small cluster of, quite honestly, old white men. And man, they ran it all. And they did what was best for them. And to hell with the country, to hell with the poor, to hell with everyone. They were going to do whatever was in their interest, and that meant banking and finance was their oyster shell. They were just assholes, and they would run banks into the ground. They would build banks up and then tear them down. They would cheat, lie. They would set up these phony scams and schemes, pyramid schemes, and the government sat there, well, government isn't supposed to be involved, free markets and all of that. Laissez-faire, that's what Adam Smith said, by golly. Well, actually, Adam Smith did not say that. One of the great myths is that Adam Smith was a free marketer. He was not. He was a competitive marketer. And there was no competition. It was an old boys club. Like I said, an old white boys club. And the working class, any minority, you name it, women, I mean, anyone who was poor was or middle class was suffering through the 1800s, later 1800s. unions were busted with the cops, with the feds, with the private militias like Pinkertons and all that kind of stuff. And this just went on and on. We would have these recessions. Now, we have a recession. We piss ourselves when we have a recession that lasts three quarters. Back then, you had recessions that lasted years. It was because free markets would swing very slowly in equilibrium. Well, we'll find that where after we've made some money off this recession and all this kind of stuff. There were a couple of movements toward reform. Strangely, in the 1890s, there was an anti-monopoly law passed because the government got sick of the monopolies ripping them off for goods and services. That kind of fizzled out. There were a couple of other efforts. There was a classic liberal administration in the later part of the 19-teens, but that fizzled out. And then we got the Roaring Twenties. Three consecutive right-wing, conservative, free market presidents and a Congress that was locked up for them. Like I said, our government was the best government money could buy. And when the rich old boys wanted to buy a judge, a senator, a representative, a president, well, by God, they were going to do it. And so we had three in a row marching us through the 1920s. And it was getting worse and worse. The rich were getting richer. The poor were getting poorer. And it was quite a time. In a way, when you have such stress on people, it's actually a time of great innovation. If you look at the art, the music of the 20s, you could tell that there was some kind of stress because it was blossoming. Incredible stuff, but that's another story entirely. 1929, it just went too far, and we had the crash of 29. The stock market just buckled. Because all the lies that had been told, all the phony financial statements, all the cheating, the side dealing, finally came to a head. And the market crashed hard. One black Monday. No, none of the fancy cats jumped off buildings. It wasn't anything like that, but it was hell. And we were really already in a very strong recession. It's just that who cares if it's just the middle class and the poor people and the minorities? Who cares if there's a recession? The fat cats were doing well. Well, once the fat cats lost a whole hell of a lot of their money, well, then there was scrambling to get even more free market, right wing, conservative. But it just, I mean, the last president of the 20s and into the first 2 years of the 30s, he was a joke. He was pretending that he was dealing with this blooming recession that was becoming a depression. As a matter of fact, at one point, it was so ridiculous. He said, well, I am building these towns for poor people. Building them. In fact, what he had done is he'd had his people build these facades. It looked like houses and buildings and shops, but it was just wood boards. There was nothing behind it. And then he had these drooling journalists take pictures of these Hoovervilles. See what we're doing? It was a joke, and it got even worse. I mean, there was a terrible incident, which I'll bring up later, called the Bonus March. And by 1932, the people had enough. Despite all of the voter suppression laws, the Jim Crow laws, and all that, the people finally spoke, and they kicked those bastards out. I mean, they kicked out every one of them, from the Senate, from the House of Representatives, and from the presidency. And we brought in a real reformer. Now, I'm not talking about someone who would be reform like a President Obama or a Donald Trump. I'm talking about someone, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He famously said, the wealthy hate me, and I welcome their hate. And the Congress passed legislation that was massive in its scope of reform. National Labor Relations Act, allowing unions to form without these thugs beating the shit out of everyone. We actually started getting kids out of the workplace. We'd had children working in factories. Their little arms were torn off. They lived short lives to maybe 20, 30 years old. We stopped that. We reformed banking laws with the Glass-Steagall Act, which was repealed in 1999. Lol. It forbade banks from offering pyramid scheme interest rates. It forbade banks from running brokerage houses on this side that sold stock to suckers on this side, their banking clients. We call those Chinese walls. It set up the Chinese walls. And we reformed the securities industry, which had been nothing but a party zone for every liar, scammer, cheat, dog beater, nose picker, and cat strangler you could imagine. They were all brought under the control of the Securities Act of 1933. The Securities Act of 1933, first, it cracked down and required that all public companies make regular disclosures. And especially when they went public, they had to tell everything about what this stock was representing as far as a corporation went. It also established the Securities and Exchange Commission, which would oversee the law and crack down on any violators. That was the first rung, but they weren't finished. In 1934, they passed the Securities Exchange Act, which brought the secondary market under control and reinforced the regular reporting requirements. So the Securities Act of 1933, it established the Securities and Exchange Commission to oversee enforcement of securities laws. And it also brought under regulatory control the primary markets. The Securities Exchange Act of 1934 brought under control and under regulatory authority the secondary markets, the buying and selling, the brokers, the dealers, the traders. They all were brought under the authority of the Securities Exchange Commission. That was a major step. And to this day, what I'm going to show you and what we're going to work with in this class is the direct result of those reforms. Sometimes we bitch and complain about reforms, and believe me, I'm a business person myself, and I really, really don't like all of the burden of regulation on me. And there's always someone who's got another idea of another paper I have to file or another compliance I have to meet, and it just pisses me off, and it hurts my business. It slows us down, it increases our prices. Okay, granted that. But at the same time, those reforms, if you don't like reform, then why don't you give up that wage? Why don't you give up your nice working conditions? Why don't you go back to brokers and dealers and traders who can lie through their teeth to you and do it without any fear? That's what we have. It's a dual-edged sword. Reform and regulation creates a burden, and it's a terrible burden, but it's also somewhat of the price you pay for a society that doesn't need revolutions and insurrections to move from one era to the next. You see, Franklin Roosevelt was facing a very big problem because there had been this movement starting in the late 1800s. It was called, for lack of a better word, it was a formalized version of communism. It was led by, it was created, this movement, by a writer named Karl Marx. And I've got a video about how this all came about. I may put a link to it, although I get in trouble every time I put it up, and I get death threats, so I have to take it down. I may put it up again. I think I actually did just recently. Okay. We had these Reds, as we called them. They had actually succeeded in a revolution in Russia, overthrown the monarchy, and they had put in a communist dictatorship. And they were in the United States telling people, you have no stake in a capitalist society. Look what it's done to you. And they were getting traction here in the United States, especially through the airhead college professors who were promoting it to their college students. And the unions were kind of embracing this idea too. On the other hand, you had the Nazis. They were already causing huge nastiness in Europe. We knew they were bad. And then they started holding rallies here in the United States. I mean, big, huge, freaking rallies. There are photographs of their rallies. Thousands, tens of thousands, with the banners with the swastikas hanging down. And they were repeating what Herr Hitler, that little dwarf lieutenant, had told them. Der Juden sind unser Unglück. The Jews are our problem. The Catholics, the gays, the gypsies, they're the problem. Kill them and bring us back to a good, strong, free market with the Aryans in control, the whites, the white males. So Roosevelt had these two forces. You had this extreme left of communism making inroads in the United States. You had the extreme right of the Nazis and their filth. So Roosevelt had to find a way that we could craft within a republic that was democratic, a way that the people had a stake and the big, powerful rich. We couldn't stop them, but we could put them under control to a certain extent. And the Securities Act of 1933, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, were major parts of that. Because as we have come to realize, finance is everything. You control the wallets, you control the world, period. You think you have a good idea for a revolution, there's probably some money somewhere behind it. But still, we at least can keep them under some control. So, we come to our current era with this legacy of regulatory reform that was absolutely necessary for us to participate in a society that could survive the 20th century. And in fact, it did. And for all the bitching we do about how bad it was and how we've got to fix everything, yeah, at least we have a fighting chance to get through it and keep going. Not by revolution, but by reform and by regulation, as long as it doesn't get out of control. And here I'm saying that wearing a mask that I'm required to wear. Oh, well, anyway, let me show you something. Now, I was in the kind of like the original era of the Securities Acts, to the extent that the filings that we made with the government to the SEC were paper documents, and there were just loads and mountains of them that we had to file. And it was paper documents in triplicate. And I'll show you, you'll see an image of them here in just a minute. And I would do that for small companies. You see, as a consultant, my work was largely a little company would find some way to go public in some weird way. And then they had no idea about this regulatory burden. They just thought, gee, I'm a public company now. I sold stock to people. And they probably did it with some mistakes and all that. But what really was going on was they didn't file their regular paperwork. And then suddenly they'd get these letters from the SEC, and they'd panic, and they'd look, they'd call around for someone who could fix this kind of thing, and I was one of the people that they were sent to. And then there was another really dirty trick back in the 90s. Oh, well, it was way before then. If a company died, it was a public company, it had a listing, it might die. There might not even be anyone there anymore. There's no even office. But the shareholders were there. So there were these players who did something called a reverse merger into a dead public company. They would make a deal for a lot of money with a private company. And they would managed to slide that private company into the dead public shell, and suddenly it would be the public company with its ticker symbol. Okay? It kind of a dirty trick. But of course, obviously, one, the SEC was going to say, wait a minute, this company was dead. It's alive? Well, you've got like 20 years of filings to do, hot dogs. Or, on the other hand, they would just be like the other companies. Well, we didn't know we had to file paperwork. What's that all about? Well, you're a public company, Cupcake. You have to make disclosures on a regular basis. So they'd call me to have me do that for them. And I did that for some years. And then that was the era when they, in the 1980s, that they started doing an electronic system. Now, originally, I was doing the paperwork. And it looked like I was a magician because back then, people really didn't have computers and they certainly didn't have word processors. And I could look like I was doing magic, hammering these things out, perfect form and all that. Well, then the SEC started a program, a test program called EDGAR, where everything would be filed electronically and there were these tags. Now, I'm sure you've heard of HTML, you know, bold, not bold, all that kind of stuff. Well, this was a precursor of that called SGML, Standard Generalized Markup Language, in which you would put these tags, title, subtitle, start of body, start of disclosure, like that. And so I could do that. I mean, it was just baby coding. And so I got a lot of work that way in their test program. Ultimately, the SEC kicked me and the others who were doing this out because lawyers and accountants figured out that this was huge money and they got the SEC to ban us. You know, whatever. But you might hear me tell you some stories about that. But anyway, what we now have is the EDGAR filing system. There's no more paper ever. It's all done electronically, and instantly, all of those electronic documents are up for anyone in the world to see. That absolute necessity of transparency, there it is. And we can look at it, and we can do financial analysis from it. Everyone uses these. These documents are the original source documents. You go anywhere for financials of a company, they were bled from those SEC documents. You can do it too. I do it. I mean, I can even report earnings for a company, just actually a tag that sends a spider over as soon as it sees a company has filed a 10K or a 10Q. Boom, I've got it, and it's on my website if I want to do that. So it's an awesome system. SEC, God. Yeah, I wonder where that would have taken me. Probably someplace no good. Okay. This is the Securities and Exchange Commission, and to this day, I still have a little bit of edginess when I come here because of my history with the SEC. Honestly, though, and I think I mentioned this before, back in the day, they were not allowed to help a company make its filings, tell it what it should do and what it shouldn't. But then, once they had told me that, then they'd say, off the record, and I'd get some help. And that made me very strong in this business back in the day. But anyway, filings. Company filing search. Now, you can type in the name of a company, but I caution against that because you could have a bunch of companies have the same name. I might have mentioned that I actually typed in the name of a company I was looking at for an investment. And apparently there was a company by the same name, and I clicked on its name, and I got financials that were terrible, and I didn't make the investment. And I, why the hell? Why is this company doing so well? And then I realized I had looked at another company, I think it was Lowe's, that had the same name, and I clicked on the wrong one. It's better to use the ticker symbol. So I'm going to use TGT, Target. Or, okay, Target, if you're into that. Now, when I speak about Target, full disclosure, I am a Target ho. I go there all the time to shop. I love hanging around there. They ask me to leave after 3 or 4 hours, but there's that. The K's and Q's. Every quarter, they have to file these documents, this disclosure document. And then every year, they round it up with the year's document. Now, Target is actually due for a 10K here very soon, in early March. But I'll look at last year's K. The K has a whole year in it. That's why I like to use the Ks in these. Now, the Qs, they're by the quarter, so you get a quarterly revenue instead of an annual. Now, the 8K, this is a statement for non-recurring events. See, the Ks and Qs have to be filed the same time every year. An 8K is filed if there is a non-recurring event. So, for example, you, sir, you are the CFO of Megacorp International. And one night, you get abducted by aliens. That's an 8K. Now, we don't have to disclose that you were actually in that field with a bunch of your friends, and you were drunk, and you were tipping cows over, and the alien mothership thought it was picking up a cow, and it picked you up instead. Okay, but I have to make a disclosure on 8K. It's a non-recurring event. It's not every day that you get slurped up into a mothership. Well, okay, 2 weeks later, you show back up at work. That's another 8K. It turned out that you and several of the cows managed to take control of that mothership, and you took it over to a cow slave planet, and you captured all the cows back, and you brought them back to Earth, and now they've declared you as the king of the cows. Uh-huh. I mean, good times. We will fight for bovine freedom. We will hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or die. Moo. Okay, I'll back away. Well, then, a week later, you say, I can't work here anymore because the cows need me. I'm their king. And, you know, this isn't just a light decision. The stakes are high. Okay. Wow. Whew. I'm trying here, folks. But that's another 8K. You see, the 8Ks tell us about things like, one of the officers or a director has died or was fired, or even what I did. These 8Ks are easy to file. These little companies, they were constantly doing stupid pump and dumps. They would send out a press release. We were on the verge of a disruptive technology. Man, I get so sick of hearing that these days because that was a scammer thing. Disruptive technology is right on the horizon for us. And they put out a press release through PR Newswire. And then I'd say, well, we have to do an 8K. Why? Because it's a non-recurring event, a press release. Well, how much do you charge for that? $50. It's really hard. Okay. And then once they'd hang up, I'd type in a quick line, what happened, say, incorporate to a Form 8K and send it through Edgar. God, I love that era. But anyway, so this gives you, and there are a lot of other forms. There are forms, for example, when you give stock options to a CEO or something like that. There are forms you have to file if you're another company and you acquire more than a certain percent of a company. It is a mass. And in there is all of that information that is always being analyzed by thousands and hundreds of thousands of analysts around the world. And now we have these Verge pseudo AI, fast machine learning programs, that are literally going in the instant those files come up here on this site instantly, and within a couple of seconds, they have fully broken down all of the ratios and all the analytics. What I'm going to teach you how to do by hand, it's all done within a blinding amount of speed now by the machines. And then some analysts go in there and have a look at it too. Why am I teaching you this if it's so easy to do? Because there's a lot that the machines don't understand. Okay, this ratio goes up, and it goes up. So that's a buy signal. Boy, is that a damn good ROA. It goes up every year. Well, I'm going to teach you on Friday that not always is a good ratio. This is where we can beat the machines. And sometimes we can even beat the fancy analysts too, because they don't have time to think about what the numbers mean. If you love numbers and that's what you want to do with your life, there's accounting. If you want to go behind the numbers and figure out what they mean and why they are doing what they are doing and what that tells us about investment prospects, you come to us, the finance people. We're very good at it, especially when we're drunk. God, you're a rough audience today. Oh. Oh. It curdled the cream. I didn't even know Bailey's could curdle. Okay. Let's take you to this 8K, this 10K. This is the setup day. And when you come back on Friday, please have your computers ready so that you can do these with me. Because it's one thing, I mean, I hate it when I talk and you guys don't have a chance to do anything with me. This way, what we're doing here, filing. Now, this is the document. It can show up just like a web page shows up as a normal document, but it's all just code that was sent in through the Edgar system. And these are actually exhibits that are in that 8K, that 10K. They're called in by reference, by hyperlink. You probably know a little about that. But let me show you. This is what it looked like back in my time. You would prepare this document on paper in triplicate. Look at this mother. That every quarter and every year. Yeah? You don't have to do any carbon copies anymore. You just say repeat file, 1, 2, 3. And, I mean, it's just so stupid. I mean, compared to what we used to do, literally, I would go to the post office and I'd have a stack like this. And this was for some small podunk company that was barely alive. And I, you know, each one had to be signed by me. But I want to show you something down here at the bottom. You see, one of the most important parts of growing up as a country and its financial system is transparency. Show us everything. Another one is the rule of law. We have laws, those apply to the kings as well as the paupers. Now, we've never achieved that, obviously, but we do make a try, we try to. In the 1990s, before the 2000s, a lot of companies lied when they did these. Now, some companies were honest, but a lot of companies were, they just lied. What they put in here wasn't true at all. And then they'd pay these outside auditors huge amounts of money to certify their lies. They'd pay their lawyers huge amounts of money to certify their lies. It all came to a head in around the year 2000 when there were a couple of dramatic, extraordinary catastrophes that came because of years of lying by companies. One of them was called Enron. And I was back in the business at the time. It was spectacular. Those cats that were running that company were they were the evil of the universe. My God, everything they said was a lie. And so, as a result of the catastrophe that came out of the Enron scandal, and I'll mention more about that in later lectures, a reform legislation was passed called Sarbanes-Oxley, S-O-X, SOX. And among other things is this. The board of directors, the CEO, the outside auditors have to personally sign these documents, which means if there's a lie, then those big dogs, they can be fined civilly, and if it's severe enough, they can be sent to prison. That's how serious it is now. So when you see these documents, almost assuredly they are honest and truth to the best of our information and belief, as we say. Now, once in a while, you have a dirty dog. We're never going to stop them. A good example of that was Elon Musk, who got his people to lie on these statements. And when he was caught, the company, which means the shareholders, got fined $70 million. So what does Elon Musk do? He went on Twitter and used foul language at the SEC. Yeah, that's mature. You see, one of the reasons that I have very, very negative opinion and judgment about the long-term prospects of Tesla, it's run by a liar who's not even afraid of the law. He won a case, a civil case, against a hero. The hero sued him because Elon Musk called him a horrible, filthy name. And Musk just got his lawyers to take care of it, and the guy lost. So when you see these, you always have to say, well, there's possibly some sociopath running the company, given. But for the vast majority, these statements are honest, and everything in them. I'll show you one that is really, really good. Down here, item seven. Management discussion and analysis of financial condition and the results of operations. We call it the MD&A. The MD&A. Now, this is a very cool thing because in this section, the company's officials give a completely honest assessment of what the numbers mean and what has happened. And they talk about competition, they talk about markets, where they screwed up, where they succeeded. It is really glib. It's honest, and it's a very cool place to look. You don't need to, well, you can go to outside people like me, but right here, these people are not going to lie to you. They're going, matter of fact, this was about 5 years ago. One guy who wrote, was one of the team that wrote the MD&A, he said, this is a hoot, because I can say all the things that I'm not allowed to say in the meetings, and I put them in here. I said, well, don't you get in trouble? He said, hell, the CEO never reads this. He signs it, but he never reads it? Well, he trusts us. Okay. Anyway, but yeah, the MD&A is awesome for getting real good information. But now let me show you this. Go back to that 10K again. This little blue button, this will take you over, and I can look at the financial statements. Oh, I could just copy and paste these. Oh, but there's something else I can do. Look at this. Every public company must provide all of its financial statements in Excel. And I mean, look at this. These can be 70 tabs long. Anything, even the executive compensation levels, it's all there for anyone to use. So you can be a hero in classes where you get term papers. You can copy and paste tables. You can make graphs, anything you want. Do your ratio analysis, which is what we're going to do on Friday. This is the thing, and it's available to anyone in the world. Transparency matched with the rule of law. That's what makes us a monster on the global scene. And we can write the rules and say, you want to join us in this party, Mr. Second World Nation? You do this. And then we'll talk about getting the money and capital you need. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.